This is a podcast from Seven Church, Bristol.
I'd like to start by asking you a question to ponder for a moment. How do you feel about the Bible? How do you feel about the Bible? I mean, your first thought might well be, well, of course I love the Bible. It's the lamp unto my feet and the light unto my path. And of course that may well be the case. But pause for a moment. Are there any other feelings that you might associate with the Bible? How about confusion? Have you ever been confused by some of the language or some of the stories or some of the ways that God or people are portrayed? Some of the seemingly contradictions that you come across in the Bible? Or does it all always make total sense? How about scared? Have you ever read something that you're not quite sure what it means? You're feeling comfortable by what it's saying. It makes you feel uneasy, and maybe you didn't want to hear it. Maybe it's challenging to you. How about overwhelmed? Maybe you've started to ask some questions about the Bible that have led to more questions and more questions, and it's starting to get like a little bit of a tangled knot, and maybe you're starting to think that probably you do actually need a theology degree to understand the Bible, and maybe you should just leave it alone. Or maybe you haven't yet read any of the Bible and you're actually wondering what the whole fuss is about. It's likely that we'll all have mixed emotions when it comes to the Bible. On the one hand, we may have got a lot of comfort and inspiration from it, but at other times, we may have felt a lot of angst about it as we've heard conflicting opinions about what certain things mean and how it applies to our lives. Owen and I have a good friend called Steve Burnhope, who is a speaker and a writer and a theologian. And reading the Bible well and helping others to read the Bible well is a real passion of his and something that he's invested many years in. For no other reason that reading the Bible well helps us to connect with God. But when we don't read it well, when we get confused by certain things, it can lead to all sorts of problems. Problems in our relationship with God and with each other and our world. If you're interested, Steve has written a couple of books. One is How to Read the Bible Well, and the other is Reading the Bible with its Writers. Both of these are aimed at everyday Christians who haven't necessarily done a theology degree, but who want to feel comfortable with reading the Bible and to be able to think critically and ask questions and be okay with that. And actually to do that is to think theologically. To think critically, that's just thinking theologically. So I'd really like to recommend those books to you, and we'll put the link both of them on the website. But Steve is very generous with his material, and so I've used some of his work as the basis for this talk today and another talk. This is a two-part mini-series that I'm starting today. I have adapted some bits for this context, though, just to say, so some of it is my own stuff that I've added. If you prefer to listen to things, then I'd really recommend a great podcast called The Bible for Normal People. And this is a really great one to listen to. There's so many episodes, but in a lighthearted way, they address many of the questions that people have about the Bible. So I'd really recommend that too. But today is a part one of a short guide to the Bible. Although Owen and Dave are just laughing because I'm actually going to cover the whole Bible today in one thing. So it's, how do you make that short? I'm going to make it, it's very succinct. So today's part one. In a few weeks' time, in March, I'm going to do part two. Then I'm going to be exploring things like what is the Bible, what isn't it, what's it for, what's it not for. And the reason why those things are so important is that if we don't understand what it is and what it isn't, and what it's for and what it's not for, then we may be expecting and getting wrong things from the Bible without realizing. And if we want to and expect to hear God speaking to us through the Bible, then we need to be understanding the Bible well if we want to be confident that we're hearing right from God. So next time we'll look at those few questions, but today I just want to begin by looking at the nature of the Bible. What kind of book is the Bible? You may have heard people describe the Bible as God's instruction manual, a guidebook on how to live, which is fine until you look for the section that's got the instructions in it, or you look to the chapters at the beginning to get some guidance and realize that they're all named after people or with words that are difficult to understand, like Leviticus or Numbers or Deuteronomy, and that doesn't really make sense. According to Google, an instruction manual is a document that provides clear step-by-step directions on how to install, operate, maintain, or troubleshoot a product, service, or application. They use simple language action verbs and often include diagrams, photos, or videos to guide users through tasks, breaking complex processes into manageable chunks for successful completion. So if you are expecting the Bible to be like an instruction manual you've previously used, you'll be sorely disappointed. Yes, the Bible does include instruction, absolutely. But you may be surprised to know that the vast majority of the Bible, about 75% of it, is story. It's narrative. And when I say story, it's actually stories within a big story, like a set of Russian dolls. So stories, within God's big story. In the Bible, the story of God is told through the stories of people. Even the story of Jesus comes to us through the stories of the people who knew him and met him and experienced him. Have you ever wondered why Jesus never wrote any of the New Testament himself? For some reason, God decided that everything in the Bible should come to us through the eyes of people, the memories of people, the perspectives and the experience of people. So what is the big story of the Bible all about? Some people choose to skip the Old Testament altogether and jump right to Jesus in the New Testament, which is okay to a point. But the problem is that the first three quarters of the Bible come before Jesus. Jesus came into a story that God had already been involved in for thousands of years. So, how can we explain the big story of the Bible, cover to cover, in a way that's easy to remember and also makes sense? Well, there's many ways that we can do this, but today I want to suggest that we think of the Bible a bit like a box set that we might watch on TV. So a box set that's made up of three seasons. So season one is the Old Testament, season two is the New Testament, season three is the one that we're in now, where we are part of the story. And as we do that, I'd like us to think of eight key episodes. And they all begin with the letter C, so it's easy to remember. So after today, you should be able to remember the whole big story of the Bible from beginning to end. And the reason for this, the idea behind this, is once we have the whole big picture in mind, it will give us the hooks to hang on whatever we read in the Bible from wherever we're reading it. And we'll understand how it fits into that bigger story. Rather than being confused by this story, if we can understand the context and how it fits, it makes so much more sense. So we're going to start with season one, obviously, episode one, which is our first C. C is for creation, which we see described in Genesis, the first book in the Bible. The book of Genesis is allegorical, meaning that it is not meant to be a literal scientific step-by-step account of how the world was made, but instead it uses imagery to communicate a deeper meaning. The question it was trying to answer was not how was the world made, but who made the world and why the world was made and what was God like? That's the question, the questions that people were asking at that time. And we see in the story of Genesis, God speaking into being an incredible world full of beauty and majesty and mystery. Each time God created something, he said it was good. And when he'd finished, he looked at the whole package altogether and he said it was very good. And despite everything bad that has happened to creation since then, God has never stopped seeing it that way. Which is why, even in its damaged state and our damaged state, God believes it's worth rescuing and restoring, and we're worth rescuing and restoring. Now, we see from the story that the high point of God's creation is people. Because unlike everything else, humans were made in God's image. Which is a wonderful phrase, but it's also a bit mysterious because Genesis doesn't actually describe what that means. But we can see from Jesus what it probably means. And it probably means these three things. Firstly, that as human beings, we have the potential to know God personally. He designed us for a relationship with him. And Genesis pictures the intimacy of that relationship in Adam and Eve walking with God in the Garden of Eden, where God is personally present with them. Secondly, that we were made with the potential to be like him by sharing in his eternal life. And thirdly, there is the potential for our lives to be defined by the very thing that more than anything else defines God, which is love. Which is why Jesus said the two greatest commandments are to love God and to love each other. But when God created human beings, for our love to be real, God had to take a risk. If God forced us to love him or love each other, we would just be like robots doing what we were told. The risk God took was giving us a choice in what we call free will. Free will, which includes choosing to love God back or to not. That's the only way our love could be real. So in the story in Genesis, when Adam and Eve decided to do the one thing that God had asked them not to, eating the fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they were exercising that free will. Their choice to do something God had asked them not to do was Adam and Eve saying, "We'll decide for ourselves, thank you very, very much. We'll work out what is right and wrong. We'll choose how we're going to live." That's free will. Now, when we read about Adam and Eve, it's important to recognize that there's some wordplay going on here that would have been obvious to the original audience that were hearing this story. The Hebrew word Adam, from which we take the name Adam, is actually the word for mankind or humanity. So the story is not just talking about an original man and woman. The story is talking about all of us. It's painting a picture of what we are all like, all made in God's image, all with free will. So as we move on to episode 2, this very good creation soon ends up in crisis, the second C. Through free will, we see selfishness and independence and a desire to be in control, increasingly dominating human life. Not just Adam and Eve, but Cain and Abel, Lamech, the Tower of Babel. All these stories together are painting a picture. Not just of one crisis caused by one couple eating a piece of fruit that they shouldn't have, but a whole series of crises of broken relationships with God and each other. We see selfishness taking control, and when selfishness takes control, it soon leads to violence, personal violence, military violence, slavery and oppression, and eventually death. Somehow, even the natural world is knocked off kilter with earthquakes and hurricanes and floods, natural disasters mirroring the spiritual and relational disasters. And because the wrong choices humanity makes have consequences, this selfishness, independence, and desire to be in control causes humanity to lose that intimate, personal relationship with God that we were designed for. So how could God restore this wonderful creation without scrapping it and starting again? Something fundamental about who humanity had become needed to be transformed. And it would need God himself to do something to make that possible. So as season 1 continues, we see this crisis that humanity has made giving way to a commitment or a covenant, our third C, that God makes. A solemn promise that God repeats again and again to different people in different stories throughout season 1. This covenant is God committing to rescue his creation. And this rescue mission starts with a commitment to a family, the most unlikely people as heroes, an elderly couple, Abraham and Sarah, far too old to have children. And God promises that he will give Abraham and Sarah children and grow their family so big that it will be a great nation, that will be a blessing for the rest of the world. In Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you so that you will be a blessing. And that's still how God works today. You know, he doesn't just bless us so that we're blessed. He blesses us so that we can be a blessing. So God chooses this family to become a nation called the Israelites that will start to model what life can look like when lived well in relationship with God. And it's at this point in the story that it separates into two different tracks, a little bit like the M6 motorway. So around Birmingham somewhere, the M6 splits and you get the M6 toll and you pay a bit extra money, you get a nicer road and a few less cars. And eventually, after a little while, it rejoins again. So just like that, what has until this point been the story of all people, for a while becomes the story of one people group, the Israelites, running in parallel with the story of all the other nations known as the Gentiles. So for the rest of season one, the story mostly focuses on the Israelites. Now, this family that has grown to become the nation of Israel unfortunately finds itself in slavery. And many of us will be familiar with that whole story. But God miraculously rescues them and leads them to a promised land where they can now live in freedom as their own nation. But the thing to remember is that the Israelites had been in slavery in Egypt for multiple generations. And as slaves, they would have been told how to live and what to do. They would have had other people's laws imposed on them. They wouldn't have had the freedom to organize and govern their own community. So now, as a free nation, they needed God's help. They needed God to give them a comprehensive framework for how they should live well as a nation and as a people of God. Which brings us to our next C, which is C for commandments. But this is not just the famous Ten Commandments we'll all be familiar with that were given to Moses on the side of the mountain. There are actually 613 of these commandments, this framework to help the people of God know how to live well. Now, these commandments are referred to in our English translations of the Bible as the law. But it's actually not a very helpful term, because when we read that word in our Bibles, the law, it can give us the wrong impression. For some of us, it leads to the impression that God is obsessed by rules, that he demands his own way of doing things in all kinds of minutiae and could smite you in his anger at any moment if you get something wrong. But that would be a complete misunderstanding of what was going on here. The Hebrew word, badly translated as law, is Torah, and it means direction, guidance, or instruction in the sense of teaching or schooling. So God is teaching them how to live well as a community, as the people of God. And he told them not to live like the Egyptians did from where they'd come from, and not to live like the Canaanites do where they were going to. All they had to do was follow Torah. And this would enable them to be in right relationship with God and right relationship with each other, loving God and loving people. But over time, this became a little tricky. You see, as time went on, Israel moved from being a nomadic people to being settled. And as a result, they needed more and more interpretations as to what the original commandments looked like now in their new context, in their new situations. And different rabbis had different ideas about that. Midrash was the common Jewish practice of debating how the Torah now applied to their new situations. It sounds quite familiar to when we're talking about the Bible and how it applies to our lives today. And it's why people were always asking Jesus, so Jesus, what do you say about this? Or what do you say about that? It's because some of these things weren't clear. Now the context had changed. And so, as the story continues, we see that living within these guidelines and instructions is not easy for the Israelites. And the crisis of human selfishness and independence continues to be so deep-rooted within them that they keep choosing their own way with its damaging consequences, rather than choosing God's way that leads to life. And then this brings us to the final episode of season one, which is an extended period of conversations. C for conversations. Conversations between God and the Israelites through the prophets. You'll see the whole of the end of the Old Testament is books from the prophets. Here, the Old Testament prophets engage in a constant dialogue with the people on God's behalf. And this is, again, God time and time again, reaching out to the people. In some of the conversations, we see the Israelites at times struggling to see God in their story, wondering whether he's abandoned them and given up on them, or if he's punishing them when things go wrong in their life, just like we might wonder at times. Now, as we're reading these stories about the Israelites, we need to remember that the issues they face are not unique to them, but their story of one nation is showing us things that are true of every nation. And during one of these conversations, the prophet Jeremiah tells them that God is going to make a new commitment, a new kind of covenant, not a new set of instructions, but a new way of knowing God. And this is some of what he says in Jeremiah. It says, "This is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds. I will put Torah in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me. From the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more." Bringing Torah within us, writing it on our hearts, is what we now understand as the presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives. And so we come to this pivotal moment, a bit of a cliffhanger in the episodes. That's the end of season one. So at this pivotal moment, season two begins with the coming of Jesus. C for Christ. Now, once again, the story opens up to all people in all nations. So the M6 toll road has met with the M6 again, and they are one road going forwards. And this was always intended. This is what the conversation said would happen. So season two is when God himself steps into our world and into our humanity to rescue what he has created from the inside, becoming one of us in the person of Jesus of Nazareth, becoming one with us. He experienced firsthand the consequences of living in a broken world, just as we have to. He shared the traumas and the hurts and the pain that comes with being human, so that none of us could ever say to God, "Oh, you don't understand," because he does. At the cross, Jesus took all of the destructive consequences of humanity's free will choices on himself, falsely accused, wrongly convicted, and murdered in cold blood. But at the cross, what looked for all the world like a defeat, what looked like the end, turned out to be the very opposite, a victory and a new beginning with Jesus' resurrection from the dead, breaking the power of sin and death. And the coming of Jesus was a taster of God's future into our present. Jesus' healings and miracles were great, but they weren't the end game. They were a taster. They were signposts pointing to how one day the whole of creation will be cleansed and healed and set free from everything that has spoiled and harmed it. Every enemy of human life gone. The ultimate enemy defeated, death itself and everything that leads to death. Jesus became the first of a new kind of people of God, according to a new pattern, a new way of being human. The Bible pictures this by contrasting what Adam did with what Jesus did. Romans 5 says that sin and death came into the world through the first Adam when he exercised free will. But the defeat of sin and death came into the world through Jesus, the second Adam, when he exercised his free will and changed the course of human history. So this is the point in the story when you're watching the episodes where there's a big cheer and a whoop in the room. This is the climax of the story. This is the high point. But it's not the end. So as we head into now season 3, here the resurrected Jesus offers us the opportunity to help create the big story moving forwards as being part of the crew. So as we imagine ourselves watching this box set, we are all part of the cast. But God also invites each of us to be part of the crew, to join him in his rescue mission of restoring and renewing this damaged world. Just as Israel was called to be the people of God, each and every one of us are called to be the people of God who will model what it looks like to live in relationship with God, to love together, to live together, to serve together, so that others can do it too. Not just as individuals, but as communities. People who don't just want to be blessed, but who are blessed to be a blessing. And then finally, we are at episode 8. This is season 3, the grand finale. This is where we see how it's all going to end. This has got a capital C for completion, or the technical word would be consummation. And just like there's an original creation story at the beginning of the Bible, so too there's a new creation at the end of the Bible in the very last book called Revelation. And again, this is described in picture language. So don't get too confused when you read it, because it's not an easy book to read, but it's all picture language. And in Revelation 21, it says this: "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away.' He who was seated on the throne said, 'I am making everything new.'" Once again, God speaks and a new creation comes into being. The reason there's no more death or mourning or crying or pain is because the old order of things has gone. The good news is that because of Jesus, this is not just a future reality, but it's also something we can begin to experience breaking into our everyday lives even now. Jesus says, "I am making all things new." So when we see broken relationships repaired, communities restored, unjust situations put right, the vulnerable made safe, the hurting comforted, people made well, that's all part of the end of this big story to restore and renew all things. And each of us can be part of this. Jesus said that all of those 613 Torah that the Israelites were first given can be summed up in the two greatest commandments, to love God and to love other people. So every time we choose love over our own desires or needs, we are shaping the end of this big story. So that is one exciting, epic, hope-filled story that involves each and every single one of us. And I'm going to invite David just to come up and play for a moment, just to give us a moment, just to ponder that, just to let some of that settle. There may be some things that triggered a thought in your mind as I talk there, just a thing that maybe you hadn't thought of before. And I just want to give us space, just allow ourselves to connect with that big story. And I want to invite you to consider a couple of things. Firstly, where do you fit in this big story? Maybe it's the first time you've heard it. Maybe you've heard it a million times. But where do you fit? And as you sit and reflect, the other question I want you to think about is, what is God's invitation to you? Dave's going to start playing, and you might just want to close your eyes for a moment. Just invite God to speak into your thoughts. Where do you fit in this big story? What is God's invitation to you? Is God reaching out his hand to you as a member of the cast of this big story? Is God inviting you into a relationship with him? A relationship of knowing you are loved, you are safe. One where God wants to restore and renew you, for you to be free, to be all that he's made you to be. Is God reaching out his hand to you? Is God reminding you of his incredible goodness? Is he stirring you again for the things that stir him? Is he bringing to mind ideas of where you might be a part of the crew of this big story, restoring this damaged world? Is he inviting you to help shape this story and join with him? What's his invitation to you?